TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg.
Oh, Jets, go!
Your official home of the Winnipeg Jets, a division of Bell Media. TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of in-depth analysis, insight, and opinion into Canada's game. And now, here's Drew, Richard, and Ezra.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us online at tsn.ca/Winnipeg, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by my good friends Ezra Ginsberg and Richard Pollock. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. And Michael Remus is operating the R desk behind the glass, helping us when we need anything of that nature. We have a jam-packed show for you this afternoon, coming up in about 30 minutes time from the Tennessean in Nashville. Josh Cooper is going to join us. Following Josh at 12:45, Bruce Daubigan of the Globe and Mail is going to join us. And then later on in the program, from Holik on Hockey, former NHL superstar Bobby Holik is going to join us. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, Game 7 gets underway tonight. You can hear it live on TSN 1290, this fine station, coming up with puck drop at 6:30. Pretty much everything you want in Game 7. Rangers, Caps, two big markets, two big cities, superstars galore. Should be a dandy.
Yeah, if you like shot blocking. I mean, it should be a dandy if you like playing good players 50 minutes a game. And benching your top players like Stepan and Kreider. And if you like watching Brad Richards and Marian Gaborik play the trap and once in a while get an offensive opportunity, then it's great. If you want to watch, you know, real hockey and skill hockey, I mean, sure, the passion is there. The offensive creativity is not. It's not aesthetically pleasing. And frankly, I think that it's a bit of a disservice to exciting hockey and maybe the way maybe many people think the game should be played. Now, it doesn't mean these players aren't playing hard. It doesn't mean that they don't want to win. It doesn't mean that they're not performing at high levels. But they're buying into the coach's system, which is Larry Brooks wrote in the New York Post this week, for somebody like John Tortorella, who once lived by the motto that safe is death, is the complete opposite of that. And I think everybody here would agree that watching the Tampa Bay Lightning play in 2004 was a heck of a lot more exciting than watching the New York Rangers play in 2012.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned 2004, guys. And first off, good morning, Drew.
Good morning, Etsy.
Good morning, Richie. This team, the New York Rangers, they obviously won the Eastern Conference, and they are winning just barely. They're winning one-goal games. They're needing overtime. In the case of Game 5, they needed a goal with less than 7 seconds left to force overtime, and they got fortunate with the penalty to Joel Ward, but you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm looking at this series, and it's turned out to be a good series. It's a close series, you know, as far as being exciting. It definitely hasn't been exciting. You have players on the ice like Marian Gaborik and Brad Richards, like you mentioned, but then you also have the Alexander Ovechkins and the Nicholas Backstroms, and sure, they've got a couple goals here and there, but you're not seeing them using their speed and their offensive skills. And I'm comparing this hockey to the type of hockey that we saw before the lockout. And we remember the dead puck era and the New Jersey Devils, and the argument against, you know, being a fan of the New Jersey Devils was always that they played the trap style. Well, the thing is, this defensive hockey is different than the trap style. Now we have the 1-3-1 system, and everyone remembers at the beginning of the year when we were talking about it on this show, when the Flyers and the Lightning were playing, and the Flyers kind of protested in game when Guy Boucher's 1-3-1 system. Well, these systems aren't that different in that you have basically a system where you're holding back. And I'm looking at these two teams, Richie, and I'm thinking that I mean we'll get into our picks, I guess, even though we don't know who's going to win the series. But
sure.
I like the New Jersey Devils to win the next round as well, because these teams are taking everything out of each other, and as far as I'm concerned, the fact that the New York Rangers can't put away these teams, and they're just barely, hanging on in certain games, is not really, conducive to beating a team like the Devils, who have now waited and had 5 or 6 days off to wait to play them.
That's a good point. And we were talking about it before the show. Not only that, as you play the seven games, but you play the seven games in a style of play that New York plays, blocking shots, sacrificing the body.
It's a hard seven games.
Exactly. At some point, I mean, if you're going to get to the Stanley Cup Final, say they win tonight and they beat New Jersey, they get to the Stanley Cup Final, they're playing a team like L.A., that's lost one game, played one game over the minimum.
Yeah.
Who do you think is going to be more fresh in the middle of the beginning of June?
I believe the, and you know, I'm not 100% sure what it is, but I believe it's that no team that has ever played, you know, back-to-back seven-game series mm-hmm. in the first and second round has made it to the Cup Final. Or maybe it's, you know, three straight seven games, they never won the Cup Final. Something along those lines where the numbers bear out that you need, you know, you need one easy series.
It's a war of attrition.
It's a war of attrition, and when you're exactly when you play five games like the Devils did,
that's right.
It's a lot easier to be. I mean, the Devils have to be bored by this point.
Well, I mean, the Kings haven't played since Sunday, Drew. They're not playing till tomorrow. They're getting a week off.
Yeah.
Phoenix, what? Phoenix finished Nashville on Monday.
Phoenix finished Nashville on Monday. The Devils finished Philly on Tuesday.
I don't know. I'm not sure people would agree with this, but I know the NBA at least would start the next round series if the teams are ready.
Right. They would have started. Well, but I mean. Yes, they like tomorrow.
Friday,
I believe tomorrow, with the NBA at 1 o'clock or noon, they're going to have Game 7 of Memphis, the Clippers,
okay.
Followed by this first game of the second round of the Heat Pacers.
And why not do that? I'm in favor of that. I mean, you want to get three games ahead?
Yeah,
maybe not even two, but one. You can start it on Friday, the LA series.
Well, it's a good question.
Or even doubleheader it today, or even start tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow they have an issue with the Lakers, probably.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably some scheduling issue.
No, Phoenix is the home team, though.
Yeah, Phoenix is the home team.
So then what's the issue there? And it's a hockey arena.
The NHL never starts one round before the other round is over. I mean, you're right. I'm not sure, unless there was an arena conflict.
Yeah, and that's not a reason, really.
I'm not sure why, unless there was an arena conflict, why the Rangers and Capitals took 2 days off between Games 6 and 7.
And if the NHL's argument is that's the way we've always done it, well, the counter-argument would be, well, that's not really a reason. Look at the NBA. They do it because there's not really a point aside from... You know, starting the two series at the same time. So they might want to look at that. I don't know if they would, but they should look at that.
And back to the, you know, the Washington-New York series, and you're watching Alexander Ovechkin block shots, and obviously he doesn't know how to do that. But Roy McGregor...
When he took it with his back the other day?
Yeah, Roy McGregor wrote a really good article in the Globe and Mail this morning that people should check out. Remus can probably tweet it out, saying that, you know, players, every level learns from the NHL. So people are starting to teach shot blocking at lower, lower, lower levels.
Well, it's a copycat league.
Exactly. And the problem is that somebody's going to take a shot the wrong way. Is it going to be in the middle of the face? Is it going to be in the middle of the chest? Is it going to be wherever it is?
Well,
and if it
you remember when, was it Trent McCleary?
Well, that was referenced in the article.
Yeah, he took the shot. I mean, he broke his larynx, right?
And he said he'd do it again.
Well, because, I mean...
And that's the thing. And
that's the mentality. That's one thing
if you're
an NHLer.
The problem is if you're an NHL and you're getting paid for it.
Yeah, if you're playing...
It's your job and livelihood.
If you're playing major junior...
If you're a 12-year-old getting taught to block shots... I mean, let's get a hold of ourselves here.
Yeah, and the thing is, we've heard this for a while. It's funny that we've been talking about the New York Rangers blocking shots the entire year, and I find it funny because I remember the year before this year mm-hmm. and the year before that year, it was as if shot blocking was going up and up, and that's probably true. But shot blocking has been a part of the NHL since the Craig Ludwig days on the Dallas Stars. I mean, shot blocking has always been a part of the game.
It's one thing if you're blocking a shot from the point and because you're getting right up next to the guy at the point, and it's another thing if you're collapsing 5D right in
that's
front
right.
of the net and
five,
letting it
yep.
five players sort of yeah. right in front of that, and it's pinballing. And,
Phoenix says that.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the difference. It's one thing if you're blocking the shot at the origin of the shot,
yep.
and it's another thing if you're blocking the shot sort of at the destination point of the shot.
And it's another thing if you have guys like Alexander Ovechkin, Nicholas Backstrom, all these
your
guys
skilled players,
you know, playing as much as Jason Chimeras and guys like that.
It's fundamentally one thing if it's a role player versus a skill player.
Fundamentally, there is an issue right now in the National Hockey League, and frankly, the hockey is close to unwatchable. I'm gonna be honest. I mean, the Washington Ranger game where Washington won was the final 2-1.
Yeah.
I watched the beginning of the game. Ovechkin scored, came back like an hour and a half later. One goal. I think it was 2-0 to the end of the game when this scored a cheap one.
That's right.
With everybody in front of the net. I mean, this is not Philly-Pittsburgh, aside from that exception, there really hasn't been much
even
else.
Philly-New Jersey was more exciting.
Yes.
I mean, New
yes.
Jersey plays an aggressive...
And so does Philly.
They both play an aggressive
yeah.
style. Everything else, I mean, you know, Phoenix-Nashville,
yeah,
same
I was
way.
I was thinking it out this week. You know, part of that is a lack of... You know, the Rangers don't have much skill in the third and fourth lines. But it doesn't excuse the fact that they have skill in the first two lines and they don't use it.
You're right. Well, you're taking the skill away from the skilled players. You might as well have an entire team
That's right.
of John Mitchell and Mike Rupps if you're going to play that style.
Like, the skill level on the Rangers is such that John Mitchell, a guy who's essentially a waiver wire pickup, who is a strong AHL player, is a good skater, can win some draws once in a while, but there's nothing in the way of offensive talent, in NHL talent, is on the second unit of their power play.
Right.
And it's a copycat league, and I mean, you know, so why?
It brings me back to this point, and people probably won't remember this, but back in 1997, so we're looking back like 15 years, the Rangers haven't been to the conference finals since then, okay?
That's
a long time. And in that year, they had a bunch of injuries, and they lost Brian Leetch, and they lost Alexei Kovalev, they lost Patrick Flaherty, a bunch of players. And Colin Campbell's a coach, Neil Smith was a general manager, and they did something similar. Dubinsky got hurt this year, so if you're comparing 15 years and how the league has changed, this year, Dubinsky got hurt. They called up Chris Kreider. They put him into the second line for periods of time. He might be there tonight, but he's been playing fourth line too. But they called up Chris Kreider, this hot shot prospect, okay?
Yeah.
In 97, the Rangers had all these injuries. Hull, I think, won the Memorial Cup, and the Rangers called up their hot shot prospect, Christian Dubé.
The Hull Olympique won the Memorial Cup. Okay.
Christian Dubé, okay? He was counted on to try and create offense. They wanted him to create offense. And that was, he wasn't penalized. That was his role. We need offense. We have guys hurt. We need offense. The Rangers need offense. That's how much the game has changed. Kreider, they bench him. They need offense, but Tortorella benches him for not getting to the spot to block the shot.
And
how the game has changed, in that you penalize the guy for one small mistake on defense and don't reward him for the offense.
And you got to remember, when they were letting Chris Kreider play in the first couple games of the series,
good.
Tons of speed,
yep. Yeah.
Impressive speed. That, you know, probably one of the faster guys on the Rangers.
Oh, for sure.
Yep.
You know, and you're like you said, you know, he is makes a slight defensive lapse, and all of a sudden he's not worth it. It's not, his offense isn't worth it.
Yep.
Well, that's such, you know, it's back.
Think about how
it's backwards thinking.
Think about how the game has changed.
Well, it's not a game where you score anymore. It's a game to keep the goals out, and if you eventually get a goal, you're lucky.
And to me, that's the biggest problem going into Game 7 tonight. And going, you know, into the next series, should they win, for the Rangers, you have John Tortorella, who, in my opinion, is not managing the team properly. And you know, I would have to agree with Richie, and you know, Drew, I think you agree as well, that if you're going to bring a guy up like him late in the playoffs, not in the season, and you're going to sign him out of college, and you're going to ask him to play a scoring role and play with Derek Stepan and Ryan Callahan. And, you know, going into the series, I thought that might be their best line. And it looked good earlier in the series. But if you're going to ask him to play an offensive role, you know, don't penalize him too much for not blocking shots. Sure, tell him how to get into the lane. Show him how Ryan Callahan does it. And you know, maybe tell him that, you know, Chris, we need you to go out there and block shots as well. But don't then put him on the fourth line, because now what you've done, you've shattered his confidence.
You've shattered his confidence. The team can't score 5-on-5. The Rangers, I mean, Larry Brooks' article, where he talks about all this, and it's available, you can find it on our Twitter, Remus tweeted it out, so search for @IllegalCurve, and you can find it there. You know, Larry Brooks talks about it, you know, you're so concerned about what these guys aren't doing, the slight mistakes
exactly
they're doing.
Right.
You're taking away any edge they can provide you. You're playing into the opposition's hands. You know, the Capitals are playing with house money at this point. What do they care if they, if they win or lose? You're the Rangers. You finished first overall in the Eastern Conference.
Everything to lose.
You have everything to lose.
The Knicks are out. You have New York. The Yankees are whatever right now.
The Yankees are middling.
You have the city right now. I was listening. You're on the back pages. If you listen to anybody in New York, you're on the back pages more than any other sports team right now.
Yeah.
You're owning the back page of New York. You need to win.
Exactly. And playing into this
style. You're playing not to lose.
The Rangers haven't scored a 5-on-5 goal in over 100 minutes. And when every game is a one-goal game, well, one bad bounce
in front of
Henrik Lundqvist is going to be the difference.
I watch these games, guys, and I look up and they show Glenn Sather sitting in the press box, and I think to myself...
With his stogie.
Forget John Tortorella, whose soul's safe as death, because John Tortorella has had a nice career, but he's not Glenn Sather. Glenn Sather's sitting up there with 5 Stanley Cup rings across his hands, watching some of the best hockey, who has watched and coached some of the best hockey of all time. And he's sitting up there in the press box, probably closing in on 70, thinking to himself, this is what the game has come to. I'm waiting to see if one of my most talented forwards will get down and block a shot to save the game instead of trying to score. He must be thinking to himself, God, what happened here?
No, I'll tell you, the game was pretty good when Gretzky wasn't blocking shots. Let's go to break. Yeah, we'll come back. We'll talk more about this series. Lots more to come. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Coming up next segment, Josh Cooper from the Tennessean is going to join us to do a post-mortem on what was a very disappointing playoff run for the Nashville Predators. Before then, we're still talking about Game 7 tonight between the Capitals and the Rangers. Also worth talking about Game 7 down in Newfoundland tonight between the Ice Caps and the Wilkes-Barre Scranton. Thank you. I was going through it in my... The Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins, they're going to Game 7 after the Penguins defeated the Ice Caps by a 4-2 margin last night. Ice Caps had a 3-1 lead in that series, and now it's down to that one game, do or die.
It's a good article by Robin Short that Dave linked on illegalcurve.com about Keith McCambridge and catching the eye of some NHL types. Not that he wasn't on the radar before, but that he's catching their eye more so now that he could be in line for a job pretty soon. I have to say, when we interviewed him on this show... Spoke extremely well.
Yeah, very well polished. Had gave the proper amount of information and non-answer that you need from a head coach.
Yeah, well, more candid I thought than most.
I thought he was pretty honest, and which is often not what you get.
And Drew, for a coach in a city that where the AHL has come back, and they won the division and they were a great team the entire year, and he helped out with the Jets. Rookie camp and all of the there are three or four players, and I mean I know that we're focused on the going into the third round of the Stanley Cup playoffs here, but there are a few players that are going to give a serious run at making the Jets next year, and we saw some of them at the end of the year. But Paul Postma is a guy that has been their best player all year and continues. I believe he got another point and last night, and he's a really good guy, and I'm really high on Paul Postma. And I think he's going to, give a couple of the veteran guys a good run there. And then you've got Spencer Mihajlovic.
Well, the question is, more so as he just started to interrupt, but does he take the spot of somebody who's maybe traded for some offense?
Absolutely.
Well, you would think so. And we're going to talk about
that the Jets would be looking to trade defense for offense.
And let's be honest, Paul Postma, he's ready for the NHL next year. He's, I think, just turned 23, or he's about to turn 23. Mm-hmm. This is when you put him in now.
Offensively, he was probably ready for the NHL this year.
Yep.
Defensively, he wasn't. And it sounds like, by all accounts, what Keith McCambridge said and what Robin Short has said when he's been on this program before, is that he has made some impressive defensive strides. And that's what the team was waiting to see him take care of, is the defensive strides. So Paul Postma was definitely the guy that Winnipeg fans should expect to see up here with the Jets next year. But really, they have to take care of business right now. They had a 3-1 they're up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They play game 6 and 7 back on home ice. There's no excuse. It would be a disappointing year, I think, in St. John's if they were to end up losing the series in 7 games after having a 3-1 lead.
Probably, yep.
And that game will be later on this afternoon. Back here in Winnipeg with the time change and everything. I believe a 5 o'clock or 5:30 puck drop Winnipeg time. I'll double-check on that.
Most games have started at 5 Central.
Yeah, because I think it's a 2.5-hour time difference, which is always the half hour in Newfoundland that makes it so unique. But there is the Game 7 between the Caps and the Rangers, and,
it's hard to predict who wins this game, Drew, just because every series is based on the bounces in front. I mean, Washington has looked pretty good, I'd have to say, and the Rangers have looked... I think they've been mismanaged by John Tortorella.
Well, that was my question. Yeah. If the Rangers lose this, they lose this series, how much of an impact, how much of a black mark does this have on John Tortorella's coaching record?
I mean, you can't have too much of a black mark because you finish first overall in the Eastern Conference and you get the team to the second round. But you have failed to reach expectations if you lose. And I think mismanaged the bench in the sense that you've looked at it. Hardly create any offense. You're moving Brian Boyle up to the second slot. You're dropping Derek Steppen down. You're dropping Chris Kreider down. And who's going to score the goals? And are you really liberating guys like Gabrick and Richards and Haglund to score as much as they really should be trying to score? So there are issues there, and you have to wonder what the direction of the team is and how they want to carry it and what the style is going to be moving forward, because you still have some good young puck-moving defensemen. Like, the thing about the Rangers, it's funny enough, guys, is they block shots and do all that garbage that Tortorella is talking about, but you have McDonough and Delzato, two beautifully skating, good puck-moving defensemen, Stahl, really solid defenseman, Girardi, solid defensive guy, block shots, in terms of not everybody is supposed to necessarily always be diving down to block shots, but Girardi's been really good at that for a while.
Right.
I think certain guys have certain roles. So you have a nice core there, and you have other guys, coming up through the system, like a Kreider, who's really talented offensively. Are you going to be playing that style, and are you going to tailor the style? That's always the question I have. I guess this is more of a long-term question. Are you going to tailor your coaching style to the talent you have? Or are you going to coach as you do and then take the players and make them what you want them to be? And I always think that's a backwards thinking.
Well, there is no... He's taking any of the skill. His team is... It's not like his team is playing with a bunch of scrubs.
That's right.
There's a lot of skilled guys on that top six there. And that's why from the start it hasn't made a lot of sense as to why they're playing this style. It's one thing playing this style in the regular season, you know, when you know, you can win, you can finish in the top of the Eastern Conference when you're playing against bad teams and playing that style.
What can Washington do, Drew? It's as if you have to play Ovechkin 15 minutes a game to the idea of that everybody needs to buy in. So you play Ovechkin 15 minutes a game and everybody's playing equal ice time and you're rolling four lines. It's like, on what team did Wayne Gretzky, Mark Messier, Pavel Bure, a bunch of like the superstar players, Eric Lindros, on what team are those guys playing once every four shifts?
None. It plays into the opponent's hands. If I'm the opponent, and it's been talked about, this isn't a revelation. If I'm an opponent, I want to see Alex Ovechkin on the ice as little as possible.
Right.
He almost scored from his knees the other game in Game 6. That was very impressive. You can't teach that skill.
Yeah. Drew, see, I don't have as much of a problem with the Washington Capitals doing it because of the fact that they haven't had the postseason success and Dale Hunter came in late. I have a problem with John Tortorella and the way he's coaching. And I'm going to be a little bit more harsh than Richie. I think that this is going to be a huge failure if they don't win this series. New York is the highest seed left. And, yeah, sure, maybe they overachieved by winning the East, and they weren't expected to win the East like the Capitals were. But I think when you've got Lundqvist, who I've said it before, I think he's the best goalie in the NHL. I'm not taking anything away from Jonathan Quick. I think you've got the best goalie in the league. The
Rangers have home ice, and they're playing an 8th. They played an 8th, now they're playing a 7th.
Right.
Seed.
Yeah. So you've got the best goalie. You've got a really good young defense, and we've talked about the shot blocking and the way the entire team plays the system.
They miss Michael Sauer, by the way.
But you've got Marian Gaborik. You've brought Brad Richards back.
Yeah, why did you bring Brad Richards in if this is the style you're playing?
And Drew, you didn't sign Brad Richards to 9 years to just get to the second round either.
No.
You brought Brad Richards in to make you a Stanley Cup winning team.
And to put the puck in the net.
He's not the Brad Richards of 5 years ago, guys, so this contract's not going to look great in 2 years.
No. Well, that's why it didn't make... No big long-term free agency contract ever makes that much sense to begin with.
Right.
Especially when it's your second opportunity of being a UFA.
That's right.
I mean, keep going, he's 31 years old.
The way that John Tortorella has the Rangers playing, it's almost like they're walking on eggshells, and they're all trying to play the defensive system and play it so well that they'll win. And safe
and
as
that
death
was the case against
right.
Ottawa, too.
Ottawa should have won that Game 7. Ottawa dominated the play in Game 7 against the Rangers.
You watched them in Game 7. That's exactly what Ezzy just said. That's the way they played in Game 7 against Ottawa, not to lose. They didn't have a puck for two of the three periods.
That's right.
And, Richie, you are right. They don't need to play like that.
They don't.
And it's not, I mean, you've got an injury to Brandon Dubinsky, and you mentioned Carl Hagelin before. Since he was suspended for elbowing Alfredson, he hasn't been the same player, and that line hasn't been good.
Is it that he hasn't been the same player, or they won't let him be that player?
Well,
he hasn't been the same player, I don't think. And he's not the most offensively gifted, but he's a good skater, and he can get in them. I think the problem, more so, guys, is Richards and Gaborik haven't been creating as much, and he was getting the residual points there.
Sure, I mean, but that's fine. You always need a guy to leech off the guys who can actually play.
There's nothing wrong with that. Rob Brown, Sundstrom, guys like that.
That's right. Guys who can make a pretty good career out of being a guy who leeches off skilled players.
Drew, I leech off you guys on this show.
Absolutely.
So if you're John Tortorella and you're entering this game and you've played, 13 one-goal games, essentially, I think there's only been one game that wasn't a one-goal game. We might want to check that. But I'm pretty sure almost every single game... Well, we know that the first
only
round...
Only one goal in this series. Only one game in this series has been a two-goal game. Every other one was a one-goal game.
And we know that Boston and Washington played all one game.
Right.
Goal game. No, there was a couple games where I think the Rangers beat up Ottawa by a couple goals. But the point is, look, you play these seven-game series, it takes a toll on you when every game is a dogfight.
Right.
You know, this game could be a 1-0 game deep into the third period again.
Well, that's why, in terms of predicting, you have two great goalies. Holpe's been tremendous, and Lundqvist is a great goalie. You have two defenses who have played pretty well, and you have two offenses that are built the same way. Throw the puck to the net, have a couple of talented players, throw the puck to the net, forecheck, and see what happens. So you're getting in the business of predicting, well, it's going to be some bounce off some shin pad tonight in a 2-1 or 3-2 game that wins it.
3-2 if it's high scoring.
And I know that I picked the Rangers. It doesn't matter at this point because it's a coin flip. But I going into this game, I think that works in Washington's favor because you've got guys like Jason Chimera and Jay Beagle and Joel Ward.
Jay Beagle's 50-50 to play in the game. He didn't play game six.
I don't think he's going to play.
You've got more grinder
Hendricks
types.
Was picking it up for him when he wasn't there.
You've got more grinder types than the Rangers.
Jay Beagle's a lot easier to replace than Brad Richards or Alex Ovechkin or Nicholas Backstrom.
And further to that point, the like you said, you've used the term house money, and it is right. There's way less pressure on the Capitals going into this game.
I want to see if the Rangers end up losing, whose fault it's going to be for Tortorella, the genius, because I'm sure he won't take the blame for it.
Well, God forbid he answers anybody's questions.
Yeah, no, exactly.
There's not much to talk about, Drew.
There's
not much to talk about. Both teams will be prepared. Yeah, there's not much to talk about.
He'll run away and hide rather than feel the heat, I'm sure, if the Rangers end up losing. Anyways, it'll be interesting. Game 7 gets underway 6:30 tonight here on TSN 1290. You can catch all the action. Let's go to break. When we come back, Josh Cooper from the Tennessean is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Let's welcome to the program our good friend from the Tennessean newspaper in Asheville, Josh Cooper. Josh, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, no worries.
How you doing, Josh? Settled
How
back?
Are you?
Doing well. Settled back in after the surprisingly short second round?
A little bit. I mean, it's kind of a weird situation. I think that even if the Preds were down 3-1 going into game 5, I think that considering all the comebacks and everything they've been through this year, that you sort of thought, they'll come back. And then they got down 0-2, and then Colin Wilson scored, and you're thinking, Winnipeg's Colin Wilson scored, and you're thinking, maybe they can come back here. You know, they've done it so many times. And then, the final horn sounded, and you saw the handshake line. You're like, wow, this is it. This season's really over.
Yeah, it happened before you know it. For better or worse, we have to start with the whole Radulov-Kostitsyn situation. That sort of overshadowed the second round to begin with. You know, we have to ask you, and feel free to take a pass on this one if you want. One of your print colleagues in New York made a strong allegation saying that the rat, for lack of a better word, was a member of the Predators media that told the organization about Radulov and Kostitsyn's night out. Any comment on that?
Definitely wasn't me. So I'm 100% accurate, positive. I mean, it was in no way, shape, or form me. So
good to know.
If that's what you guys are asking or implying, that's not the case.
No, we didn't think it was you so much. But what do you think? What do you think about the if that's true? And there's no way of proving right now if it is or isn't true. What do you think about that, a member of the media, sort of whispering in the ear of management in that regard?
Definitely strange. I mean, it's, as you know, with hockey, it's just you walk a fine line sometimes with knowing these guys, knowing these players, knowing people in management, knowing the coaching staff, maybe even being friends with them to a slight degree, and doing your job. So, it's tough to really know just because, you don't know what the situation was. It could have just sort of been a reporter, hearing about it and then asking for comment on it. And then all of a sudden it's like, wait, well, we didn't hear about this. And then all of a sudden you're blindsiding someone. So, I think that there are more moving parts to it than just basically saying a member of the media ratted them out. I think that there are just certain elements of it that are gray areas that are just sort of, I don't know if we'll ever know. I don't think David Poile or Barry Trotz will ever say what exactly happened. So, there's a lot of different things that we have to do from, journalist, beat guy perspective when we hear about such situations, asking for clarification, asking for comment. And, if you hear about something, you say, well, I heard these guys were out. Can you talk about it? It's like, whoa, we didn't know they were out. So, right. That could have been it. It could have been one of a number of different situations and scenarios. So, especially in hockey, where people seem to get a lot closer all around the sport than in other sports, say football or basketball or baseball, it's always kind of dicey.
Yeah, Josh, first of all, let's qualify the fact that we weren't implying that it was you at all, so I don't want you to think that. Michael Farber wrote in SI that, at least that came out, I think, yesterday in a piece, that apparently they were the curfew was exceeded. They came back about an hour after curfews. We have no idea at all. Is it common in terms of like a curfew violation? First of all, I guess, is it common? Like, do the Predators have a curfew all season, or is that just a playoff imposed curfew?
You know, I don't know if there really is a curfew, to be quite honest. You know, I just, in terms of kind of looking at the whole situation, and I mean, I think that a lot of it is just simply, you know, exercise your best judgment. I don't know how much of it is, you know, referred to just as a curfew, if you will. I mean, I think that, you know, when you sort of look at that situation, they did go all the way to Scottsdale. It's about a 45 minute drive. That's a long ways away to go if you're going to, you know, try to go out the night before another game. I know that there are some good restaurants over there. I know that there are some good spots. And, you know, as a hockey player, I mean, I've been to Scottsdale. It's not a bad place to be. So, right. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's I don't really know if there really is a curfew per se. I think that, you know, a lot of players don't really go out that late to test it, if you will. But, you know, I think it's more kind of an exercise your best judgment. And, you know, I think that it may have been a situation where the Preds just sort of thought it was more of a principle type thing to go all the way to Scottsdale rather than kind of stay in the hotel and be around the rest of the team. Just because, I mean, if you're a player, I mean, you can be in your hotel room and be up till 4 a.m. And
what's the difference? Right.
So, you know, I think that could have been it as part of it.
Do you think that overall, I mean, just your personal opinion, and forget the perception around, do you think that the Predators handled the situation appropriately?
It's a tough question, or a tough way to answer that. I don't know. I mean, they lost, so you're going to, you know, automatically say no, and hindsight is 20/20. I mean, if they won, then maybe you say yes. I don't think so, to be quite honest. You know, I think that maybe sitting them for that first game in their heads was the right thing to do. The second game was probably not the smartest thing to do. You know, you just sort of, I think there are some questions now. I mean, I think that, you know, forever Barry Trotz and David Poile have been almost Teflon, if you will. I mean, they've sort of,
right.
They've ruled the roost here, and, you know, the ownership here is local, but I don't know if they, you know, if a situation arises to where you have to question them, I don't know how they would do it. You know, those two basically have extreme levels of power, so, and rightfully so to a degree. I mean, they've won a lot. I mean, the proof is in the pudding, but so this is the first time where really I think you can hold their feet to the fire and really ask them, did you do the right thing? Did you treat the situation the right way? You know, did your team operate in a way that it should have operated in a situation where they were the favorites and they had the talent and just the gumption and the wherewithal to win the Stanley Cup? And, you know, I think there are some questions about that now, more so than there ever been in the history of this team.
Josh, you know, this is a multiple choice question. Where do you think Alexander Radulov is going to play next year? Is it going to be A, in Nashville, B, on another NHL team, or is he going to go back to Russia and play in the Continental Hockey League?
You know, I don't think he goes back to Russia, just because I think by coming here, he sort of saw, and, you know, maybe he could just only because of the money, but I think that if he does, then we'll know where his intentions are. And you know, I think that, you know, in talking to him and seeing him operate, that he does want to play against the best players in the world. You know, I think he comes back. Does he come back to Nashville? I think there's going to have to be a lot of meetings on that, just because, you know, it was a tough go around for him first time with Barry Trotz. You know, the two didn't see eye to eye on a lot of stuff, and I think that how it ended here this time really sort of kind of exemplifies that maybe things haven't changed as much. I mean, they said all the right things when he came back, but maybe there's more to it. So, you know, I don't know. I think that he wants to be in the NHL. I think that being here was eye-opening for him and what he has to do to kind of get back to being one of the best players in the world, be it conditioning, being mentally, being how the NHL game is played and sort of recalling and remembering all that stuff. But, you know, if he does go back to the KHL, we will know exactly the reason why. It'll just simply be for the money.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Josh Cooper. He's the Nashville Predators beat writer for the Tennessean newspaper.
Certainly not a lack of storylines in Nashville, Josh. Probably a good thing for you. Ryan Suter is a pending UFA. The most sought after, certainly, the most sought after defenseman coming up this summer, starting July 1. Do the Predators have I think they probably have a realistic chance of re-signing. Do they have would you put them as the favorite, so to speak, going into free agency?
I'm not quite sure on that, just because I think so. But the way it ended really, you know, if they had just maybe gotten beaten by Chicago in a seven-game series in overtime in the second round, I think that there's sort of this kind of feeling of unfinished business with Ryan Suter. You know, I think that there's different sense here. I think there's a sense that, you know, the team did all it could and it just got beat on a bad bounce or a bad hop here. I mean, the way the Radulov-Kostitsyn issue was handled, the fact that the Predators were heavy favorites and, kind of to a degree choked against Phoenix, I think that maybe sort of alters his thinking. I think maybe he sort of wonders, you know, if I'm in Detroit and I have the same level of talent, would the same thing happen? You know, if I'm with a perennial front runner that knows how to handle these situations, would the same type of situation happen? I think that Nashville's a good spot for him. I think that if you do keep this team together, if you do keep Alex Radulov, if you do keep Suter, Weber, Pekka-Rinne, add, you know, a few pieces here and there to kind of fill in the gaps a little bit, I think they have the makings of a perennial Stanley Cup contender, just because you do have more talented people in the NHL, maybe the top two defensemen, maybe one of the top wingers in the league, and then on top of that, one of the top goaltenders in the league. I mean, that's a hard out any year in the playoffs. The question is, you know, if what he does and how it sort of plays out here, just because maybe he wants to test the market. Maybe, he's talked to his uncle Gary Suter, who's, I don't know if he has or not, but I mean, you know, basically said, you should test the market. I think that he has earned the right to do so, just because he has played very well and, mm-hmm. It's his right in the CBA to go check it out. So I don't know what he's going to do. I think the Nashville is a good spot for him, but at the same time, and if all those pieces do come back, I think you have the makings of a perennial contender. At the same time, I do think he has really, he has earned the right to test the market and see what he's worth out there with other teams.
Josh, towards the beginning of the interview, you mentioned Colin Wilson, who's obviously from Winnipeg. How does he factor in if he does factor into Nashville's long-term plans?
I don't know. I mean, we asked David Poile about that on breakout day. And, he basically sort of said, to a degree, you know, he's played well, but he has to be more consistent. And I think that's kind of the issue with Wilson, is just simply the fact that, he's shown these flashes of being a dominant power forward in the NHL. He's got a big body. He can keep people off the puck, good vision, good shot. Showed some really strong defensive responsibility in the playoffs and then put him in. The issue is, can he do that on a night-to-night basis? And I think that's what they're questioning right now. I mean, I think he can. I think that sitting the first round of the playoffs kind of showed him what he needs to do. But at the same time, you know, I think that there are questions from an organizational perspective of, can they get that night every night with him?
Final question, Josh. Shea Weber, I mean, obviously Ryan Suter is garnering much attention. Shea Weber, another year, I guess, RFA and then UFA after the following season. Is it going to be a similar idea to last summer, just get him for 1 year? Are they going to try and, once they're able to, speak to him long-term?
I'm sure they want him long-term. The question is, what does Shea Weber want to do? I mean, if the Preds sort of kind of go out, let Ryan Suter walk and take the same tack they did last offseason of, oh, you know, we're going to build from within and bring our guys up, and our younger guys are going to come in and fill those holes. I mean, last year, the way the season started out, that was not a good track at all. And Pekka-Rinne saved the Predators pretty much every game for the first 2 months of the season. I think Shea Weber knows that. I think that you need to have some of these older, more talented guys in there. And yes, you know, are the Predators more experienced? They are. But at the same time, I mean, with all due respect to a player like John Blum, he can't come in there and replace Ryan Suter. Ryan Ellis can't replace Ryan Suter. I mean, you need to go out and get guys who can replace these guys, and sort of the ownership, which is said over and over again, they have the money, they have the resources, they have to step up to the plate and really show these guys, this is what we can do, this is what we will do, and we want to bring a winner to Nashville. And, until they actually show them that they do that, I think that maybe he would sign a one-year deal, just simply because they have to kind of, they have to show him, and they've talked the talk, but they really do have to walk the walk, just only simply because you look at how it played out during the season. All the guys they picked up were unrestricted free agents, so it's not like they were getting guys long-term to kind of keep the Predators going. I mean, it just sort of led to some more uncertainty, and I think that's certainly going in Shea Weber's thinking right now.
Josh Cooper, thanks very much for this. Have a good summer.
No worries. I'll do what I can.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll probably talk to you between now and the start of the next year anyways. Thanks again, Josh.
Great time.
Take care. Josh Cooper from the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville. Let's go to break. When we come back, Bruce Dalbiggin from the Globe and Mail is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. In case you've missed any of the program, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Let's welcome to the program the Globe and Mail. He's our good friend, Bruce Dalbiggin. Bruce, good afternoon. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, man.
That's good. Got to start with this. It sort of made the news, raised a lot of eyebrows around Canada and the hockey world in its entirety. Ron McLean's controversial opening from Game 6. Ado about nothing, or Ron sort of making himself the center of the story, as tends to be his reputation as of late?
Well, he sometimes tries too hard, and I mean, I can appreciate what he was trying to say, but he certainly, it came off wrong. And having worked in live radio and TV for a number of years, I don't generally hoist guys for stuff that happens on the air, but this was a prepared piece. I mean, they clearly had time to think about this. They went and got some video, et cetera. So it's not just Ron. It's the entire Hockey Night in Canada bunch. It was pretty tasteless. And coming off of several other incidents this week where, you know, he and PJ Stock were making jokes about dumps and stuff like that, I just thought that, I know everybody's tired, but this is the big show in the country, and there's a higher standard for it, and I don't think that Hockey Night met that standard this week.
Bruce, we know that Bob Cole and Gary Galley are going to be the first duo for CBC in the conference finals. Who's going to be the second duo for CBC?
Well, the lead is Jim Houston. It's going to be Jim Houston and Craig Simpson. They'll be doing the lead game. And when CBC gets a second game, I think I got to go and look and see whether they've announced the announce crews. I don't believe they've finalized the announce crews. I mean, Bob Cole was the announcer for the second game in the early part of the playoffs in round two. But, for a guy who's almost 80 years old and who lives in Newfoundland, to have him over on the West Coast running around doing that sort of stuff, I wrote in my column, I think it might be ill-advised. And, it'd be nice to see somebody like Dean Brown get a shot, but you spent the whole season building up Mark Lee and Kevin Weeks as your number two team. I think they should be the guys to do it.
If they spent the whole year building them up, as you say, because they definitely did, they had all the doubleheader games, why did they choose to use Bob Cole for the second round?
Well, that is a good question. I mean, whatever you think of Bob, too, most of the games he was doing, you guys in Winnipeg would have, you wouldn't have seen most of the games that Bob did this year. I know we in Calgary didn't see them. For a lot of us, we might have seen Bob maybe four or five times this season. But I think it was an attempt to be a little bit traditional, maybe a little sentimental, going back to the Bob Cole card. And, I just don't think anybody at CBC knows how to tell Bob goodbye. And this is another example of it.
Bruce, much is made of the U.S. ratings year after year after year. And it's a question. Yeah. My question is, this year the Rangers might make a run, and obviously L.A. is in, so ratings have been pretty good. And in past years, if you have teams, like a Carolina-Edmonton final, and the ratings won't be that great. Are the U.S. ratings simply based upon the market size and who's actually making a run? And if so, why do we get excited when when the ratings are high 1 year, and why don't we get disappointed when the ratings are low 1 year?
Well, for the most part, the American market's like the Canadian market. And when your team isn't playing in it, a lot of people in Canada just start watching something else. So they're on the Blue Jays or whatever else there is.
Right.
And the American market's been that way for a while. One of the things that kind of surprised everybody last year, though, was the fact that they had a Vancouver and Boston final, and the ratings in the United States were good. A lot of people at NBC and the NHL reconsidered their kind of their preconceived notions about Canadian teams being on American TV, and that it was death for ratings. To such an extent that we're going to see Toronto and Detroit be the game on New Year's Eve day this year for the Winter Classic. So I think there's indications that maybe the larger hockey audience in the United States will accept something other than just their regional team. I still think that to a large extent we have hockey fans in Canada, but it's amazing how many of them tune off when their team is not in the playoffs. I mean, you look at the viewership numbers in Quebec, now the Canadians are out, they're maybe 20% of what they were during the regular season. Vancouver and some other markets, fairly similar to that. So You've got a real hometown influence in both sides, but I think the Americans, and especially the NHL, what they're doing these days, they're really trying to build up the brand, trying to build up the NHL brand, so it's like the NFL one. It doesn't matter where the big game is. It's the big game. We're going there.
We're joined on the line by Bruce Daubigan of the Globe and Mail. Bruce, for the majority of the first round, I had the pleasure to be down in the States and was pleasantly surprised at the amount of hockey coverage I was able to see with all the games either on NBC Sports Network or the NHL Network or CNBC. You know, with the new deal that the league entered into with NBC and the NBC Sports, you know, network and the channel of stations, you know, has the flexibility to air the games on a number of different stations really been a boon to the coverage down in the U.S.?
Well, it was a very conscious decision, and I think it was a smart one to do it and to make sure that every playoff game got national exposure. That was one of the things the NHL wanted from NBC. NBC didn't pay a ton of money. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you consider $2 billion over 10 years in broadcast terms, that's not that much. But what the NHL wanted was national exposure for their games. And I was in the United States for part of the playoffs, too, and I was sitting in a bar on 7th Avenue in New York watching two hockey games at the same time. And I thought, well, this is pretty good. In New York City, when the Knicks are in the playoffs and the Yankees have started the season and the Mets, et cetera, that we're sitting in a bar in New York City, both of these games are on. So that's what the NHL wanted. That's what they've got. It has helped their ratings. And you know, there is kind of a coolness factor about the NHL at the moment. We'll see how it goes in the playoffs if somehow we end up with Phoenix and New Jersey. But, you know, I think there's a coolness factor about it, and I give full props to the NHL for what it did in terms of getting national exposure.
Bruce, the NBA playoffs started a little bit later than the NHL playoffs this year. Have you had a chance to look at the ratings, and has it had some type of impact on the NHL playoff ratings?
Well, I don't know if there's a quid pro quo for, you know, the NBA does poorly, the NHL does well. But the NHL has done well, and the NBA ratings are, I would say, average, mediocre at best. Part of that in the NBA, of course, is we've had a lot of the top stars have been injured. I think a lot of people were put off by the labor disruption that delayed the start of the season. There just hasn't been a whole lot of snap, crackle, and pop for the NBA playoffs on TV this year, and the ratings reflect it. But to say that the NHL is taking away any viewers from that, that would be hard to say. What I found interesting this season is that Bill Simmons, who writes for ESPN and Grantland, the website that he does, he lives in Los Angeles, and he had decided this year, because of the labor lockout, he would go and get season tickets for the L.A. Kings. And at the end of the year, he would decide whether he would keep his L.A. Kings tickets or his L.A. Clippers tickets. And the last I saw, I think he plans to keep his hockey tickets. So I guess that's a good thing for the NHL in the United States. So the guy as influential as him is sort of, you know, thinks that hockey's cool and worth keeping the tickets.
The NHL in the past, Bruce, has had a penchant for scheduling games at the exact same time. This year they seem to have moved away from that, luckily for the viewer, and they've staggered the start times. What do you think of that decision, and are we going to see even maybe more staggering in the future to not have as much overlap?
Yeah, they've consciously done it. In fact, I was talking to one of the major Canadian sports broadcasters the other day, and he was still complaining about the fact that games were running over into his game, it was hurting his ratings, etc. But they've taken the example of March Madness, the NCAA basketball tournament, and how they stagger the games so that, you know, you get to halftime or intermission of a game, you might be able to flip over and see another game still live. I think it's been a positive thing. If they had their druthers and they didn't have to play against each other each night, they would certainly do that for the TV audience. But, you know, you'd have a playoff that starts March 1st and then July 1st, so, you know, it's not practical.
Which is, I mean, the NBA's first round is still not over. It's been about three weekends worth. It's never ending, and it's actually, I think, a disservice to the viewer, even though the games are more staggered. So, I mean, as much as the NHL is staggering them, they're also keeping in mind that, you know, you don't want your first round to go for a month.
Yeah, well, but they want three weekends in the first round. There's no doubt about it. Both the NBA and the NHL want to have three weekends in the first round. It does stretch it out a little bit and does make it seem endless. Now, obviously, if all of the series end in five games, you can't do that. But if you've got a couple of seven-game series, which the NHL did have in the first series, and obviously the NBA is having, you can do it. And, you know, that's what they want. They want those weekend ratings. And, you know, as much as we don't like it, that's just going to be the reality.
Bruce, we were talking quickly in the first segment before our last question. The NBA they actually do schedule next round games, so second round games after first round games or on the same day.
Yes.
Did the NHL give any consideration to that, considering that Phoenix and LA have been sitting away for so long?
They have thought about it. I think if you were able to get some weekend dates that worked to start a little earlier, they might consider it. But by and large, it's not something you're going to see the NHL do. They don't think it works for them. They're going to let their teams rest. And, you know, honestly, in the playoffs, you know, we see the toll it takes on the players. I think a lot of people in the NHL, if they get a chance to rest their players a little bit and have a better product in the next round, they're going to try to do that.
Final question, Bruce. You know, you've been doing this for a long time, and the hockey we've been watching lately, I mean, some of the ratings have been strong, but the hockey we've been watching lately, for the most part, is congested, and Roy McGregor wrote a good piece about it in the Globe, and you've written about it. Are the TV executives at all concerned about the lack of exciting, you know, the actual quality of play and the lack of excitement on the ice?
Well, I mean, the executives' first thing is the advertising being sold. If that's okay, then they're happy. Are the ratings good? Then they're happy. Then they'll address the style of play. We in Canada are much more obsessed about that. What I will say is that, you know, the NFL and the NBA have decided that they're going to let their stars be stars. The NFL is a perfect example where they've liberalized all the rules about pass interference, so they made it harder, I guess, to defend on a star receiver because they want the quarterbacks and the star receivers to be stars. They want offense. The NBA has done a number of things to try to make sure that their stars, you know, are able to perform and do the stuff in the playoffs that they do in the regular season. In the NHL, and in particular in Canada, it's all sort of bass backwards that way. You know, people in Canada seem to think that, oh, no, I'd rather see Jay Beagle as the hero of the playoffs. You know, there's this whole ethic about wanting to see the unsung guy be the hero. And, you know, everybody likes a Cinderella once in a while, but, you know, the steady diet that we get that's produced by the style of hockey that we're having here, it doesn't appeal to me. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a series in which Wayne Gretzky was the star of the playoffs, or that, Jean Beliveau was the star of the playoffs, or Gordie Howe was the star of the playoffs. These days, coaches shut those guys down completely. The style that you have now, it's very hard for an offensive star to do anything in the playoffs, unless we end up with all these second and third guys. And I personally, for myself, and as I've written, it doesn't appeal to me. I think, you know, one of the things Eric Duhatchik suggested, and I've been thinking about this too, is maybe we need to look at the basketball equivalent of the 3 seconds in the key. Maybe you can't stand in front of the net for more than 3 seconds without having to get out of the zone. I don't know what it is, but I find it very stagnant. It's as if you have two football teams and they're both running the wishbone offense at each other, and it's you know, it's monotonous, and which team plays that style best is winning. And I don't find it fun. Last year when we had Boston and the Canucks, there were two teams with two definite styles. And you know, you felt like when the series ended that one style would have predominated over the other. And it was more than just whether you rooted for Boston or Vancouver. This year it's going to be, you know, whoever plays the prescribed style best and who has the hottest goalie is going to win the cup. I don't think it's going to stand as a year in which you look at it and say, wow, that was really satisfying from an artistic point of view.
Bruce Daubigan of the Globe and Mail, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Okay, guys, thanks.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks,
take care.
A lot, Bruce.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to start our Western Conference final preview. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Five minutes past the top of the hour, a big thank you to Josh Cooper of the Tennessean and Bruce Daubigan of the Globe and Mail for having joined us in the previous hour. In case you missed any of those interviews, they will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. Remember to follow us on Twitter, @IllegalCurve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website with all your latest hockey and Winnipeg Jets news is www.IllegalCurve.com. Gentlemen, the Western Conference Finals get underway tomorrow after a lengthy layoff. Both the Coyotes and the Kings dispatched their opponents relatively easily in the last round, and they've been sitting at home waiting patiently. You know, how do you see this series playing out? These are two teams that really start with their strengths in the back end. You know, I think talent-wise, there's undoubtedly the Kings have a strong edge over the Coyotes, but we've been saying that for the last couple series, and the Coyotes still seem to be able to find a way to pull it off.
Well, Drew, you know, going into this series, and nobody predicted that this was going to be the Western Conference Finals, and one of these teams was going to go to the Stanley Cup Finals, especially with the way L.A. played in the beginning of the season, and they had to bring Daryl Sutter in. But, you know, Heading into this series, I think people are going to look at the two goaltenders first off, Mike Smith and Jonathan Quick, whose save percentages seem to both be, you know, 980 or whatever. Mm-hmm. They're not quite 980, but they're both 930, 950, whatever. Yeah. It's ridiculous and almost unheard of to have that save percentage this late. But, you know, going into the series, I think this series is going to be a little bit more lopsided. I like the LA Kings. And the Phoenix Coyotes, in my opinion, have overachieved too much. And I mean, you got to call a spade, and you have to admit that you're wrong when you picked Phoenix to beat Chicago and then Phoenix to beat Nashville. As far as I'm concerned, everything went wrong for Nashville, and nobody assumed Radulov and Andre Kostitsyn were going to be suspended for games 3 and 4. And, you know, going back, I still would have picked the Chicago Blackhawks, and I still would have picked the Nashville Predators. And if you go back and look at each one of those games, they were outshot a lot of the time. They were outplayed. But how did they win? Well, Mike Smith does what Mike Smith does, and he plays unbelievably. And all indications are that he is going to play unbelievably. But when I look at the LA Kings beating the number one and number two seeds and doing it quite easily, and the way the top line is played, Dustin Brown, Anze Kopitar, Justin Williams, and then Mike Richards, Jeff Carter, and Dustin Penner on the second line, I'm looking at this series, and I have to think that the LA Kings are going to beat the Coyotes in at most five games the way they're playing. And I just don't see how the Phoenix Coyotes can again get outshot, get outplayed, and just rely on Mike Smith, essentially, and timely goal scoring. I just don't see how they're going to do it for a third round in a row.
Richie, doesn't talent at some point have to win out?
You'd hope so. I mean, it's hard to pick any series. You've picked series in five before us, but, I mean, every series seems to be just going to six games. So who, I don't know. LA is obviously the more talented team. Phoenix has nobody on their team that is as talented as Kopitar. I mean, they're going to probably put Hanzel up against Kopitar, big guy against big guy, and try and match that up, and then I'll leave Richards with a little bit more freedom. Richards, Carter, Penner line. LA's offensive talent is better than Phoenix's offensive talent. Nobody on Phoenix is Doughty, although Ekman Larson is going to be a darn good player. There's no Doughty there. The rest of the LA court's playing pretty well. I mean, LA's a more talented team. There's really no edge in goal. I wouldn't think there's much of an edge in goal. If anything, it's probably Quick by a hair. Mm-hmm. So when you look at it overall talent-wise, and you have Daryl Sutter against you know, Dave Tippett. Look at overall talent-wise. LA is a better team. They've played two better teams on the way there in terms of playing Vancouver, and then they beat St. Louis. And the truth is, they should win the series. I'm going to pick LA in six because I think Phoenix will slither its way through to two games. They'll play. It'll be low scoring. I mean, LA is not that fast, and Phoenix will slow everything down, and they'll try and make it a one or two bounce on a 5-on-5 and try and limit their penalties, and that's what they're going to do, and that's been a success for them. I mean, they played against Chicago, you know, they beat Chicago, and I thought they were going to beat Chicago, but they didn't have the puck for most of the series.
A Chicago team that we find out this week was pretty much dysfunctional from top.
Yeah, but we kind of knew that before.
Yeah, we did, but I mean, it sounds like the dysfunction ran pretty deep in the Chicago Blackhawks organization. So, I mean, you can...
Yeah,
you
it still does, frankly. Yeah. And that was a good article by Dave Schultz in Globe and Mail about that.
And Elliot Friedman touched on it significantly in his 30 Thoughts. Remus will tweet out both the Schultz article and the Elliot Friedman 30 Thoughts about it. But, I mean, at some point in time, I mean, look, the Blackhawks may or may not have had a... The Blackhawks series could have gone either way. When you have four games go to overtime, you know, when you go to... Five games go to overtime, pardon me. You know, the Blackhawks could have just as easily won. The Predators obviously had a significant discord with the Kostitsyn and Radulov situation.
Yep.
And didn't know how to handle being the favorite either.
That's right. And they didn't know how to handle it, and they took Phoenix too lightly. LA Kings, you know, can say that they're the underdog because Phoenix has home ice and everything. I mean... Yeah, it's hard to say one way. I mean, to me, the Kings are the favorite, but, you know, I don't think that's going to be an overwhelming motivation one way or the other. And the Kings, at some point, are just a better team.
Drew,
you look at the forwards on both squads.
I don't think Phoenix has anybody who's as talented as Kopitar, Richards, or Carter, really.
Right.
And you could certainly make an argument, Dustin Brown.
I would agree with that. And Richard, I mean...
That's four guys.
You look back at last series, I don't think Nashville had anybody like Mike Richards who will
That's
take
right.
the team on their
That's
back
right.
and say, this is what you have to do to win this round.
That's right. And you know what? And at some point in time, somebody's got to expose Phoenix's lack of top scoring. And Phoenix's, you know, sometimes, you know, the veteran, those slower veterans on defense, the Morrises and the Coins. I mean, Coin is old and he's slow. You have to take advantage of those situations. I think LA is just a better team. And, you know, it's you want to rain on the Phoenix parade, and who knows?
I thought Phoenix would make the second round. I didn't think they'd beat Nashville. But I think their run ends here.
And, Richie, heading into that series with the Predators and the Coyotes, it was, can the Phoenix Coyotes top pairing, which now is Oliver Ekman-Larsson and Keith Yandle, could they shut down Irat Fisher and Sergei Kostitsyn, which has now emerged as their top line?
Irat Fisher and Sergei Kostitsyn don't strike any fear into anybody's hearts.
Compared to Andrei Kopitar, Justin Williams, who am I forgetting here? On the top line of LA.
Dustin Brown.
Sorry, Dustin Brown, Conn Smythe favorite, or Conn Smythe candidate at this point.
And
sorry.
Then a second line of
that
Richards,
line is
Carter,
a lot more
and
intimidating. Yep. And the problem is, and then, yeah, you get into the David Schlemkos, who's played a little bit in relief. And
he moves the puck, well, we take advantage of him defensively.
Right.
Take advantage of Okoin's lack of speed. And Derek Morris's sometimes brain farts that he has. And you know, he's not as good of a skater as he once was. Never the fastest player in the league. He can move. He's a little bit slower now. As, I mean, you have Ekman-Larsson, a really good young defenseman. Yandle's not great defensively. They're going to put that puck down on the boards, and they're going to work Phoenix to death behind the net.
Yeah.
And they're big enough and strong enough to work them over, and that's where I think the series will be won.
And L.A. right now, over any other team that's left, including the Devils, is finishing right now. And those guys are getting goals. And when you look at the two teams that they played, Nashville, you had players that, unfortunately, either weren't able to show what they could do in Radulov and Andrei Kostitsyn, but then the players that were left. And I talked about this before. We're going back to the Nashville Predators here, but before the season, towards the end of the season, I was saying that if David Legwan and Mike Fisher, their number one and number two centers, didn't take the team on their back and improve their play offensively, they weren't going to go anywhere. And Legwan actually was one of their best players in the first two rounds, but you know, he's a 60-point player. He's not the type of guy. Andrei Kopitar and Mike Richards, these are guys that year after year, you know, produce offensively, and they're getting it done. And, you know, I can't believe I forgot Dustin Brown. But, I mean, Dustin Brown, I mean, what more can you say about the guy? Not only is he getting timely goals, he's getting shorthanded goals, he's getting even-strength goals, but the guy is putting other players on their backs. He's physical. He leads the team in hits. And they have two of those guys. They have Mike Richards as well that can do that. And then you look at guys on the back end like Drew Doughty and Willie Mitchell have been playing well. And Voyanov, mm-hmm. who stepped in for Jack Johnson. Quick, who hasn't really had a bad game yet. And that's why, you know, I'm gonna say it right now. I'm going to take the Kings in five.
Well, let's hear your prediction. So it goes with the Kings in five.
I told you the Kings in six. I mean, just look at this. Every time I even want to think about considering Phoenix, I look at their roster. Then I vomit.
Well, at some point in time, I mean, you know, you're being tongue-in-cheek, but at some point in time, you're right. You know, unless the NHL has gone so far off the deep end that the only thing that matters is system, 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 and you can win with...
Does any Winnipeg... Let me put it to the Winnipeg Jets fans. Was anybody at that game this year, the 1-0 game in Winnipeg?
It was paint drying. I was watching paint dry.
Awful.
Phoenix.
I fell asleep in the middle of the second for half an hour.
Phoenix didn't try and score until there was about a minute left in the game. That was the only time they sort of opened things up. They were quite content to lose 1-0. And they did. I mean, it was paint drying. The Phoenix Coyotes are not Stanley Cup material in the way that Cup winner. Yeah.
Similar to Minnesota making that conference final run in like 2003, I think it was.
Sure.
Devils played the Ducks in 2003.
Right. After they knocked off Colorado in the first round
and Vancouver,
and
in,
Vancouver
the
in the second. Yeah. Exactly right.
It's worked for the first two rounds, but I unfortunately, the way the LA Kings have disposed of the Vancouver Canucks and the St. Louis Blues, I just don't think it's going to work again. I don't think they're going to be able to shut down these players and rely on Mike Smith. I mean, how many times can you get outshot 40-25 and win?
Well, you hope this would be the last time, because I don't want to see the Phoenix Coyotes in the Stanley Cup Finals simply for the entertainment
value.
Well,
nobody will want to see it, and nobody will watch it.
Exactly.
Nobody will watch it in Canada, and nobody will watch it in the States.
Exactly. That's pretty much what it boils down to.
We know nobody will watch in Phoenix.
Yeah. Plus, the better team needs to win, and the better team is the Los Angeles Kings. They should win, and, you know, I'm going to say the Kings are going to win in six games also. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to focus our attention on the Eastern Conference, talk about the New Jersey Devils.
The Devils.
And how they've come this far.
Eddie's prediction.
Eddie's prediction.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the program. This segment is brought to you by Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, home of Canada's only coal-fired pizza oven. Taste the difference at Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, 1580 Taylor Avenue, pizza baked, well done. Carbone, the official sponsor of the Illegal Curve Overtime Pool, could be quite likely, I would say, that there might be an overtime tonight.
Yeah, it feels, you know, well, there was an overtime in Game 5
Yeah.
But it feels like, you know, there's been, what, 4 or 5 days without an overtime. There was a little while where we had an overtime every day.
Well, yeah, an overtime every hour for a little while there. So, of course, follow Illegal Curve on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. If we go to overtime, there's the overtime pool. You get to pick your one player. And if you pick correctly, you win great Illegal Curve merchandise.
You know what, Drew?
And you also win great Carbone merchandise as well. Gift cards and that sort of terrific things and from the official sponsor, Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza.
Yep.
The owner of Carbone has been fitted with an Illegal Curve hat.
An Illegal Curve hat available at City Hall on Cordon Avenue. That's so right. Get out there, get your official Illegal Curve hat.
Do we have hats there? Because they ran out.
No,
we have get them. Did we hats there. We restocked?
Yeah. Oh, they're there.
We did some restocking.
Lots of hats available. Illegal Curve hats available at City Hall.
You've been, everybody's been a little bit tame today, and Michael wanted to come in and talk about some things that have been happening.
You know, I pulled up and parked my car behind Ez, and he says, good thing you came at the same time as me, because I don't have a key, and Richard and Drew probably wouldn't let me in. Apparently, Drew, you deleted Ezra off BBM this week?
I certainly did. I make no apologies for doing so. What you have to understand is that there single-handedly is no person more annoying on BlackBerry Messenger than our good friend Ezzy over here.
I think Richie will concur with that.
I think Richie will concur. 100%. Richie is... it's not that you're nicer than I am. I think you're stupider than me, because you get as equally annoyed with him on BBM as I do, yet you don't delete him. I delete him.
Can you explain to the listeners what Ezra does to be annoying?
Hold on, but...
constant messaging in the course of the workday.
Lots of highs.
Lots of highs. No purpose to the messaging. If it's, hey, Drew, I need you to send me something, sure, I can take care of that, no problem, won't have an issue. But it's, hi, what's up? Hi. Ezzy, it's Tuesday at 2:30. What do you think is up? I'm at work. I'm doing work. This is what you should be doing as well. You should not be BBMing me annoying nonsense.
Yeah, and you know, Drew, in your defense, we've known each other for 15 years.
We've
been friends for about one of those 15.
Maybe at most.
But I deserved it. And we should qualify this by saying this isn't the first or even second time you've deleted me off of BBM. This is like the third or fourth time you've deleted me off of BBM. I did deserve it. I was annoying you. I actually didn't.
And for the record, after I deleted you off BBM, you started emailing me annoying things. I mean,
I didn't find out, but you know, just for the record, I didn't find out that you deleted me until Richie told me, and then I was still sending you messages, and they weren't going through. So that's how I found out. But I did deserve it, and you know, I want to use this opportunity in front of the thousands of Illegal Curve fans listening right now. I want you to take me back on BBM.
I'll consider it. It's unlikely it's going to happen, I'll be honest, but I'll consider accordingly. Okay.
What would I have to do to get... to earn your trust?
Just be less annoying.
Okay. I don't think I can do
that. No, I don't think you can do that either. That's why we're probably not going to... it's probably not going to happen. But thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Michael.
Clear the air and you know, provide some sort of insight into the behind-the-scenes dysfunction of Illegal Curve.
You know, well, I heard that there was some issues going on. I thought we should, you know, bring it up and talk about it. And for the record, me and Ezra have a very healthy and loving BBM relationship.
We do. See, the thing is, our personalities are conducive. And the thing is, I find that people on social media and BBM, they often
a TED Talk?
They often take it a little bit too seriously. So once again, Remus, I appreciate that for bringing that up. It's good that we air our grievances over the air. And Drew, I hope that you reconsider adding me on BBM, because I only have two contacts right now, Remus and Richard. So.
I'll consider it. It's unlikely. We'll see how the rest of the show develops. How about that? Let's talk briefly, and we'll talk about it more extensively, of course, throughout the program, of the Eastern Conference Finals. The Devils sit and have been waiting patiently for their opponent. You know, Game 7 tonight, the series is going to start Monday, either in New Jersey if the Capitals win tonight, or in New York if the Rangers win. You know, tell me why the Devils aren't going to win the Eastern Conference right now.
Well... because the Rangers and Washington both play such tight styles that it's hard to beat them in six, seven games. And it's also very difficult to predict, you know, how each game will materialize, Drew. The thing about the Devils so far is they played a little bit, played a Florida team that just didn't have the skill levels them, worked pretty hard, didn't have the skill levels them. Then they played Philly, who played it open style, didn't respect them a lot, and New Jersey had a very good game, took advantage of them. Now, I'm not saying New Jersey can't do that to either the Rangers or Washington. I think those teams are a little bit more disciplined than Philadelphia. I think that the Rangers and Washington, right now with the Devils' rest, the confidence they have, and their ability to create offense with their top star players, and I think, you know, what we're seeing with New Jersey is interesting, as he's been on this for a long time. And we talked about this many times throughout the year. New Jersey plays their best players the most. They ride Kovalchuk. They ride Parise. They ride Zajac. They ride these guys. And they added depth at the deadline. So it's different than these Washington, New York teams and Florida or whoever else it is who's playing their good players, you know, a minimum amount of ice time or not allowing them to, you know. New Jersey will put two forecheckers in the offensive zone as opposed to some will put one with, a, you know, with kind of two guys high back, by that high. In the neutral zone, they'll put two forecheckers on the defenseman. Most teams in the NHL put one. They'll activate their defenseman, which most teams do in the NHL, in the offensive zone, and have a guy curl back and defend, you know, the third forward high to curl back and defend to continue to sustain offense. And they will, their goal is to create offense and use their speed, guys like Parise, guys like Kovalchuk, and skill level. Because really, you look at their team, as and you have Parise and Kovalchuk and Zajac and Eliáš, Sikora, Ponikarovsky, Henrique.
Zubrus, who had a great second.
And Zubrus is the least skilled of all the people I just mentioned, offensively skilled.
And he's been terrific.
And he's been terrific. Yep. So when you have that, you're trying to, this is what you give DeBoer credit for. And he never had this to work with in Florida. He has offensive creativity and talent, and he's coaching the team to pressure and use that talent, especially in transition and on turnovers, because their speed and hockey skill creates turnovers.
And
the addition of Zdlicky, which we said at the deadline, is a great addition, because if you watch that team in Winnipeg this year or on TV in any other times, they lacked an offensive defenseman.
Right.
And while Marek Zdlicky may not be the best defensive defenseman, he helps facilitate offense at the blue line. His health was obviously going to be very important for the next matchup, but he helps facilitate offense not only at the blue line and the power play as breakout passes.
Yeah.
He pushes everybody down a slot, and he allows people to be in more entrenched roles. And another thing, if you're playing against a team like the Rangers, you have a nice advantage, because if the Rangers can't score those second, third, and fourth lines, or any line really, you're going to match up Volchenkov against Richards and Gabrick, and you're going to say, okay, beat me with your other players.
With Brian Boyle.
And they don't have Sean Avery this time waving his stick in front of Martin Brodeur. But you know what? The Devils played so well against the Philadelphia Flyers and really dominated them and actually managed to do what the Philadelphia Flyers did to the Pittsburgh Penguins and get them off their game. And I look at, you know, how Giroux obviously was frustrated and Scott Hartnell was frustrated, and those were their top players, and basically Jaromir Jagr was ineffective and other players just didn't do what they could do. I thought, you know, Danny Briere still had a good series, but the New Jersey Devils really played, you know, their A game versus the Philadelphia Flyers, and Marty Brodeur, you know, played well enough to get them the win, and obviously Brizgalov didn't have a very good game five, but the New Jersey Devils are looking really good going into this series, whether it's against the Rangers or the Capitals. And, you know, Richie mentioned that Peter DeBoer likes to play Ilya Kovalchuk and Zach Parise and Patrick Eliáš a lot. And this goes back to shot blocking and defensive hockey. And I think, you know, one thing that has to be mentioned here is that Peter DeBoer will put Zach Parise and Patrick Eliáš out to penalty kill.
Great point,
Ezzy. And the first penalty kill line. And you look at a guy like Zach Parise, and as far as I'm concerned, whoever gets Zach Parise, you know, next year is just, you know, essentially winning the lottery, because the way Zach Parise is playing right now is incredible. He's blocking shots. Patrick Eliáš is blocking shots.
Not only do they play those guys in the penalty kill, but best penalty kill in the league this year.
Again, best penalty kill.
It doesn't
in the
make
league.
It play your best players in, you know, in all situations. If they're skilled enough to play in that situation and responsible enough to play in that situation, and they are, it's just a matter of if they buy in, and those guys obviously bought in. It doesn't make any sense to not play your best players in those situations where they're going to maximize.
You don't have to be a shot blocker necessarily to be a good penalty killer. You can be smart enough to get to the places and get in the lanes before the puck goes there, or create the push the puck to the boards, things like that.
Keep
idea
outside.
That you have to be a great shot blocker to succeed this league as a penalty killer or anything else is absurd as far as I'm concerned.
You know what's better than blocking shots? Not even letting the shots be released in the first place.
Absolutely.
Keep them to the outside. Keep the passes going on the perimeter. You're doing the best job as penalty killing as you possibly are. An interesting note, obviously we don't know who the Devils are going to play. Peter DeBoer and Dale Hunter hate each other.
Yeah.
They hate each other from the junior hockey days.
Probably good for fans, right?
Well, that'd be another layer
of entertainment
there.
I don't know enough about it. Obviously, there's articles written about it. But London Knights aren't exactly known as, how do we say it, the most ethical of Ontario Hockey League organizations.
That's very diplomatic.
There were some rumors that the teams that they had made those runs with the Patrick Kanes and Sam Gagne and players like that, there were rumors that those players were, shall we say, well taken care of.
Sure. College football well taken care of, right?
Those are the rumors.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would be another.
And you heard, it's not one you've heard from one random. So those are, right. People.
Where there's smoke, there's some fire, as it tends to be.
Right.
So that would be another layer that you could add into the entertainment value of a potential Eastern Conference Finals in that case.
Because DeBoer was with Oshawa for many years.
DeBoer would play.
Quickly getting back to the New Jersey Devils, and I know we're right up against a break here, but, and Richie touched on this a little bit. When you look at their lines, and one of the things that Peter DeBoer did that I think he should have given more credit for is that he took Zach Parise off the top line.
Yep.
And to play with Eliash and Clarkson. And the thing that I think people should consider for the New Jersey Devils and why they're going to be hard to play against, for the Rangers or the Capitals, I don't think it matters who they play against. I mean, look at the Philadelphia Flyers. Everyone thought the Flyers were going to win the Cup easily after they beat the Penguins. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened? The Devils beat them in 5 games. You look at their top 3 lines, and you look at guys like Adam Henrique, Zubris, and Sikora. Well, that's your 3rd line right now. Yeah. So, I mean, and you've taken Parise off the top line. You've put Ponikarovsky up with Zajac and Kovalchuk. So, really, they have the ability to keep their same. It doesn't really matter. I mean, their top line, sure, you've got Zajac and Kovalchuk with Ponikarovsky on your top line. But then Parise and Eliash is your 2nd line. Really, you've got 3 number one lines there. The way I look at it, you can move guys around. Sikora probably is the one guy that really wouldn't factor in as a 2nd line guy because of his age. But the way Eliash is playing, Adam Henrique, I mean, this guy, he came out of nowhere. He played with Taylor Hall in Windsor, and he has just emerged as an A prospect for the Devils. It's unreal.
Great.
And when you can throw out a guy like that as your 3rd line center, I mean, it's going to be tough
and
for the Rangers or Capitals to match up
against
that.
And the moment hasn't been too big for him.
No, it really hasn't.
He stepped into the spotlight, and he's embraced the extra pressure
Most players that skate at his speed, he kind of reminds me of a Matthew Lombardi.
Yep.
And that smaller stature, left-handed shooting a centerman. The difference between Henrique and Lombardi is when Lombardi skates full bore, he doesn't have the same control of his own body, essentially, and the puck as Henrique does. Henrique can skate at full speed and still have complete control of himself, and that's a very difficult skill to teach.
Let's leave it there. When we come back on the other side of these commercial messages, we're going to talk about the Philadelphia Flyers and do their post-mortem on their season. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.